GBW Denmark, Green Bay's real news and great conversation, a civic media radio station.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packard. Brian Koberger sentenced to life in prison without parole today for the killing of four University of Idaho students. The Wall Street Journal reporting Attorney General Pam Bondi and her deputy Todd Blanche told President Trump in May that his name appears in the Jeffrey Epstein files multiple times, along with many other high-profile individuals. The attorney general reportedly recommending to the president at the time not to release any more files, and the president deferred to the AG decision. And Ghislaine Maxwell, the only person to be convicted in the Jeffrey Epstein sex trafficking ring, has been subpoenaed to give testimony to the House Oversight Committee. Tennessee Republican Tim Burchett is on that committee.
Everybody says, well, she's going to lie. I said, well, if she perjures herself, she goes back to her original sentence.
The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, in a 2-1 decision, upheld a lower court ruling that President Trump's executive order ending birthright citizenship is very likely unconstitutional on its face. This is ABC News.
As Wisconsin as a fish fry on a Friday night, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
The Brewers remain the best. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. Baseball, the Brewers with another win. They beat the Mariners in front of over 41,000 fans in Seattle, 10-2. Bryce Tarang with 3 hits and 5 at-bats, driving in 3 runs. So the Brewers win the series, and at 61-41, still have the best record in Major League Baseball right now, manager Pat Murphy.
I think you got to understand that this is a bunch of people that, you know, have gotten to this point and just kept clawing away. You know, they're hungry.
Up next, the crew hosts the Marlins on Friday night. NFL Packers training camp underway, but center Elgton Jenkins not participating as he waits for a new contract.
You know, Elton's always done right by us. I think we've always done right by him. But we're excited to kind of see him move to this new position because we really do think he has an opportunity to really help our football team. And the team needs as many reps with him out there as possible.
That's the Packers GM Brian Gutekunst with sports. I'm Mike Clemens.
Who's looking for some free family fun at Fisk Park? It's Amanda with another new Wisco 411 for you, brought to you by Area 509 in Appleton. And National Night Out is on Tuesday, August 5th from 5 till 8 p.m. at Fisk Park. This is a nationwide event held on the first Tuesday of August, which brings residents, local law enforcement, and first responders together in a positive and safe setting. There's going to be lawn games, face painting, arts and crafts, concessions, food trucks, and so much more. Get in on the action. Check it out. Go to WGBW.FM and click events.
Tom Hartman here. You're listening to 97.9 WGBW.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Evidently, Mike Johnson, Speaker of the House, didn't want to deal with the Epstein thing. Evidently, we're adjourning for the summer. Summer vacation starts a little bit early because we want to tap down the Epstein thing. Prediction, Mike, it's only going to get worse. Especially as you've got Congressman Thomas Massie, the Republican from Kentucky, who is going to push forward with the idea of releasing the Epstein files because, you know, as he says, at least a dozen Republicans support his proposal to push this through because people want it. Trump ran on it. This was part of the conservative movement forward. And what do we get from Trump? Well, he's calling on the Justice Department to charge Barack Obama. Yeah. Because understand, he says whether it's right or wrong, it's time to go after people. It's criminal at the highest level. And the meme that the White House shared, which was, you know, something like, I was hunted, now I'm the hunter. Because he claims he's going to go after Obama. I guess Biden's on there, Comey's on there, Clapper, all Brennan, all the... Because that's going to rile the base. And if that doesn't do it, if going after Obama, I'm surprised he didn't throw Clinton in there. But if that doesn't rile the brace, then, you know, the sports team name, that'll do it. You know, the Cleveland and the Washington teams, That'll get people, at least his base, all tingly in the panties, all bunched up, all you know. So they don't pay attention to the fact that the Wall Street Journal reported that the economy's set to slow. What they claim is leading economic indicators are saying, hey, with the impact of Trump's tariffs, the price increases that are coming in the second half of the year, expect a slowdown. And you look at the price of beef, gone up almost 9% since January. And CNN saying that could be even higher and more stubborn than egg prices have been, because they haven't brought those down either. But hey, at least we've got crypto, right? Interestingly enough, the new Gallup poll out, only about 14% of Americans said that they would buy cryptocurrencies. The other side of that, 60% said not interested, never interested. And when you find out who the crypto bros are, they tend to be conservative, younger men, and rich people. So are we surprised at all that Trump media, the people who control the Truth Social, that they've acquired $2 billion worth of Bitcoin? We shocked, especially after the signing of the quote-unquote Genius Act. I'm telling you, I'm not fond of the geniuses who voted for it. But hey, at least we're not talking about real things, like the Labor Department. Right now looking to loosen regulations on workplaces that, interestingly enough, you know, you've got immigrants working at. It's quite remarkable if you stop and you think about it, what this administration is doing and getting away with. Because I'm surprised, I got to be honest, I'm surprised CBS actually even reported on this. The Department of Labor, they want to rewrite or repeal more than 60 what they call obsolete workplace regulations. You know, those job killers. So we can go back to people killing. Things ranging from minimum wage requirements for home health aides to people with disabilities and the safeguards governing harmful exposures. You know, like dangerous things in mines. Now understand, you know, if this goes through, we're looking at some pretty hefty changes in the workplace. And look, it's going to affect working conditions in construction sites, in coal mines, in mines, and also simultaneously limit our government's ability to penalize anyone who breaks the rules. If a worker gets injured or killed, well, you know, oops, better luck next time. Now, the Labor Department says we're just trying to reduce the cost of these burdensome regulations, you know, put on us by those previous presidents. And also, they want to deliver on Trump's promise to make America great again and prosperity through deregulation and all that stuff. And what I find interesting is when Republicans talk about jobs Americans won't do, they're talking about the jobs that they want to make even worse. We're going after immigrants right now in a full tilt boogie fashion. And they're the ones who do these jobs. And look, understand, generations of immigrants, often desperate, always hardworking, they're the ones who have taken these backbreaking jobs. Long hours, pathetic pay, barely any protections, if any. All because, well, someone's got to pick those strawberries, clean those hotel rooms, process the chickens, lay the bricks, do all that work. And understand, every American family has those grandparents, those great-grandparents, those stories of, yeah, came over on the boat, got a job laying brick on the street. You know, my great-grandfather, during the Depression, in Berea, Ohio, they laid brick on one end of I guess it was Main Street, all the way down, and then turned around and flipped the bricks over to come back down the street. That's how they made a living. And now we hear Trump and his Republican cronies, oh, it's about job killers. What they're about to do is ramp up the cruelty. So they're deporting more people. We're basically criminalizing ambition, turning the border into war zones. And interestingly enough, I haven't heard corporate America screaming enough. Hear the whispers of, you know, who's going to do all these jobs? And understand, it's not just about the border. It's about decades of deliberate organizing by Republicans to deregulate, defang, and destroy anything that protects workers. They've spent my entire adult life gutting wage protections, fighting unions, axing OSHA rules, and making pretty darn sure that whoever does the dirtiest, hardest work in this country is left just a little further behind, a little more desperate, and a little more powerless. And the people who are suffering most in this moment are obviously the immigrants. They're the ones who take these jobs. And understand, it's always been this way. People so hungry for a chance that they'll risk everything for jobs that pay less than minimum wage. Offer no health insurance, no retirement security, and if you get hurt, leave you with injuries and bills. Bills you can't afford because you can't get health care. And now you got Trump and the GOP who don't just want to keep those jobs awful. They want to make them even easier for employers to exploit, all while waving the flag and demonizing the very workers who are honestly holding this system together. And let me ask you this. I mean, honestly, if Republicans really cared about American workers, why have they fought so darn hard every time a minimum wage hike is offered? Why have they cheered as companies replace steady work with temp gig jobs, independent contractor schemes? And why, after decades of pro-business policy, are so many of us, native-born and immigrant, working harder, longer, and for less while still falling further and further behind? This is a classic bait and switch, my friends. The Republicans rail against illegals stealing jobs, but what they're really doing is protecting their donors' right to run sweatshops and pay starvation wages. They want you to blame your neighbor instead of the billionaires writing the big checks. Classic robber baron divide and conquer. Immigrant labor in this country, not new. But the conditions, the misery, the shadow economy, the total lack of a social safety net, those are features of Republican policy. It's not an accident. It's an on purpose. And every time someone stands up to demand dignity for all workers, higher pay, safer job sites, a real pathway to the American dream, here come Republicans screaming, amnesty, job killers, socialism. All while they cut more safety inspectors and do the wink and nod to wage thieves. Here's what working people in this country need, no matter where you are born. Strong, real labor protections and a government with the guts to actually enforce them. We need minimum wages that are actually livable. We need OSHA inspectors with teeth. We need real unions at every shop floor across this country. And we most certainly need to stop letting politicians sell us on the lie that making working conditions worse for them, you know, them, will ever make our lives better. Because the ultimate conservative con game here is simple. Deregulate, then exploit. Then blame the most vulnerable. And when it all goes to pot, act shocked. I can't believe it. And of course, promise more of the same. Look, I've spent enough time on picket lines and in break rooms to tell you, if you let the boss treat anyone like dirt, sooner or later they're coming for you. It's a race to the bottom, and the only way out of that is for all workers to stand with each other, not against each other. That's simple. So let's call out this for what it is. It's cruelty. Let's reject the policies that make it harder for people to make a living, especially in the jobs that are the hardest jobs to have. And let's make sure that we build a labor movement that demands dignity, respect, safety, fairness on the job. That's where I want to go. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Back after this.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So the last couple of days, we've been talking about the one big miserable nightmare bill that Trump and the Republicans rammed through on the 4th of July. 4th of July, freedom, Freedom Day. And what that's going to mean for people going forward, what it's going to mean to healthcare in the country, what it's going to mean to, well, people like me who are going through some severe healthcare issues with my wife and eventually probably going to need Medicaid, even though we've taken almost $1 trillion out of it. And here to share some thoughts on, well, how bad? How bad is it going to get? I've asked Laura Packard to come share some thoughts with us. She's the founder of Voices of Healthcare Action. You can check out her website, laurapackard.com. Laura, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with your personal story first. Let's go there, because you've been on the show a number of times, talked extensively about your battle with cancer. You've credited the dreaded Obamacare with saving your life. Now in the post Trump big beautiful nightmare bill, what does someone like you of the future got to look forward to?
Well, I went through cancer and the fight to save the Affordable Care Act in 2017. And I did not know at the time that here we would be going again, that 8 years later, that under President Trump, again, we would be facing fights to repeal our health care again. And this time they succeeded in cutting $1 trillion from our health care, mainly Medicaid, but failing to extend the tax credits for the Affordable Care Act, as well as wonky, people can explain this better than me, but sequestration rules, I think, means $500 billion cut from Medicare as well. So they are coming after every piece of our healthcare system. And me personally, I have a plan through the Affordable Care Act. And this year, 2025, I pay in the $400, $450, something like that, a month for my health insurance. But I am afraid that it's going to skyrocket, because next year I won't qualify for subsidies, because people that make over 400% of the federal poverty limit will get nothing. And that is, for one person, $62,000. For two people, $84,000. For three people, $106,000. So if you make more than that, you will get nothing. You will pay the full price without any subsidies for your health insurance. And they're saying it could go up 25%, 75%. I will find out in September when I get my letter. But as a cancer survivor, I have to pay whatever they charge me. I have to pay. Yeah. I can't go without it. So if it costs more than my rent, I still have to figure out how to pay it.
And look, I know they can't deny you for pre-existing conditions, but I assume going forward, especially as we've weakened protections for people, that you know, we can't deny you, but we can charge you to a rate that would be, well, much higher, no?
Right, because I won't qualify for any help, so I am completely at the mercy of the insurance companies for whatever they want to charge me. And an added thing that I will be going through is that next year I turn 50, which I am incredibly grateful to have made it to 50, since that was not a given. People ages 50 to 64 will face the absolute worst of it, the highest rates, because we are too young for Medicare, but we are starting to be at the age in which insurance companies want to charge us more. So They can't charge me more for being a cancer survivor, but they can charge me more for being 50 and up.
For being old, yeah. When you think weird, because we've got age discrimination laws, but never mind that. But, you know, what I was asking also is, you know, someone in you who went through what you went through, going forward, you know, what chances do they have? Are they going to be left behind? Or you know, as some of the studies that I've seen, are we just ready to let, you know, what was the number I saw? 30,000 people at the high end, 17,000 at the low end, die every year because of, well, 11 million. Was it 11 million people are going to lose health care?
I think the last numbers, and they were editing the bill every day. So I think the last numbers I heard was that 17 million people would lose their health insurance. And that is a combination of people losing their Medicaid, people who cannot be able to afford their Affordable Care Act policies anymore, and so on. So the Affordable Care Act, these price hikes and the lack of help will hit middle-class families, self-employed people, people in the gig economy working multiple jobs that don't provide health insurance. It will hit us the most, and Medicaid will hit working-class families the most, and people that are caregivers, people that are students, people that are disabled, lower-income people the most. So they're going after everybody. They're going after lower-income people. They're going after middle-class people. The one group of people that they don't seem to be attacking are the billionaires who got their huge tax breaks in this bill.
Boy, did they. So let me ask you this, because, you know, we've talked about your pre-existing condition. Are we concerned that at some point down the road, the Republicans are going to go and maybe have a big, beautiful health care bill that's going to repeal those kind of protections or weaken protections for people with pre-existing conditions?
Well, I think that they may have learned from 2017 in the fight just how unpopular it was to repeal the Affordable Care Act altogether, you know, because people with pre-existing conditions would be uninsurable. So instead, what they're doing is they are going for a death by a thousand cuts. By making it unaffordable, then they're not taking away health insurance from people with pre-existing conditions. They're just making it so we can't afford it.
And removing us towards a pay or die system, which is what they've always wanted. I've said that for years. So in this big, beautiful nightmare bill, I mean, bring us the wonk. How bad is it? What's in it? What can we expect? What are we not being told? I know there have been talks of, the more you learn about it, the more you're going to like it. I understand this is the more we learn about it, the less we're going to like it. What are we missing?
Well, the important thing is anything that's good in the bill, anything you think that, that sounds like a good idea, it turns out to be very gimmicky. It's only available for some people in some ways, or only your overtime and not your regular. It's very gimmicky, not available to everybody. And second, it's time limited. It's going to expire in the next few years. But the tax cuts for billionaires and corporations, that's forever. So
as it should be. It should be, because we need a billionaire class, Laura. We need the biggest billionaire class ever. We need to tighten the belts a little bit more. We need to eat box mac and cheese. We need to do everything we can to enrich our corporate masters, because that's evidently what's important.
Well, that's one of the reasons why they're going to make Medicaid near to impossible for many people to keep. And they're saying, we're not cutting Medicaid. We're just getting rid of waste, fraud, and abuse. If they wanted to go after waste, fraud, and abuse, they could go after the $1 trillion that insurance companies are getting off of Medicare Advantage, overbilling the taxpayers.
See,
but instead, going after individuals on Medicaid and making it impossible for you to jump through all those hoops to keep your health insurance, because they know more than 90% of people on Medicaid work or are full-time caregivers, but they are counting on it being so hard to stay enrolled that people will give up, just like that's what happened in Georgia when they tried it.
Right.
And Arkansas.
No, but here's the thing. As a stage four cancer survivor, you're the waste. You're the fraud, you're the abuse. That's their definition of it. Giving people health care, especially when they need it at their most desperate hour, it appears to be. I don't know what's actually in their soul. I just know what's in their policy. That seems to be the waste, fraud, and abuse. People like you, people who need it, getting the care that they need.
Well, also, an insurance card doesn't cost anything besides a few cents to create it and mail it. Medicaid has some of the lowest reimbursement rates compared to Medicare and other programs. It's the most cost-efficient way of providing care. So the way you save money from Medicaid is you kick off people that are using Medicaid. You know, if somebody is in their basement eating Cheetos playing video games, they are costing $0 to our healthcare system. It's the people that have chronic diseases, that are disabled, that are in nursing homes on Medicaid. These people are the ones that are costing Medicaid, because Medicaid is paying for their care. You only save money if you get rid of people that need care, that cost money.
Which, again, I go back to the some of the studies that I've seen anywhere. I think it's between like 17,000 and 30,000, if I remember right, people who are going to die each and every year, somewhere in that range, because of the lack of health insurance, not going to doctors to get preventative care, not following up on care that you need, not taking the drugs that you need, not doing the maintenance that needs to happen. And ultimately, I would argue, costing our system much more as illnesses get much worse. And, you know, we use the ER once again as the family doctor.
Mm-hmm. Right. That is the most expensive way to provide care. So if you are making it so that more people don't have health insurance, they will get their care in the costliest way, in later stages of diseases where it is more expensive or impossible to cure them. And also, cutting this much money out of the system means hospitals will close, and that affects everybody. And maybe your hospital doesn't close, but all the people that went to the hospital that's closed are now going to your hospital too. Yeah.
No, and what I've been saying, and what's resonated with some folks, is, you know, look, I've got the best healthcare money can buy in this country. We are at the top, we're the Cadillac plans, they used to call it, because my union negotiates for it. But what good is having that card that doesn't cost a lot of money to produce if there's no hospital or a healthcare system to go to use it, or if I've got to go hours away? It just seems that this is, you know, what did Ben Franklin always, what did he say, you know, penny wise, pound foolish. This seems like a whole lot of that.
Exactly. But the billionaires need their tax cuts, Rick. So,
of course.
I mean, one of their goals is to force people, whether they are able to work or not, force people with disabilities, force people that are caregivers, force people that are dealing with chronic conditions back out in the workforce, because all of the people that have deported that are picking vegetables and doing construction work and so on, those jobs still need to be done. Yeah. So how about you force people who are going through medical crises to do those jobs?
Yeah. And what we just talked about a minute ago, how about we just we deregulate those industries, make them less safe, so we can attract literally nobody to them. Last question I've got for you, as founder and organizer there with Voices of Healthcare Action, you're out there talking to people. Are folks getting what just happened? Is there a sense of in your mind, is there a sense that we know how bad this is? And if not, you know, what should people know, and how should they organize around it?
Well, hospitals are already starting to close. A hospital in Nebraska already announced, and we will see more and more of those over the next couple years. The Medicaid cuts theoretically don't kick in until after next year's election. I wonder why. But already hospitals are closing because they know they don't have those funds that they can count on. And states have to balance their budget. So states are going to have special sessions this year, maybe, and sessions next year where they figure out how to deal with these cuts. So Medicaid cuts, slow motion. The really bad stuff is coming in a little while. Affordable Care Act is right now. We're going to start getting letters in the mail in September with the new rates for next year. And assuming that Congress doesn't solve the problem of the missing subsidies, it's going to be gigantic. So people are going to get those letters in September, going to take effect January, the new rates. So that's happening real soon.
Yeah, and look, they didn't have to kill Obamacare, and by legislation, they're just going to starve it of the resources that it needs to exist, so folks don't get the care that they need and the insurance that they as a citizen, I think you deserve, earn, however you want to frame that. Laura, I appreciate the time. Great work. Voices of Healthcare Action. You can check out Laura Packard's website at laurapackard.com. Laura, as always, great stuff. Appreciate the time.
Thank you.
Want to hear your thoughts. It's bad, isn't it? And what part of it is going to affect you, or don't you know yet? I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for Matt Nair on Air.
As Wisconsin as a game of cribbage with good friends, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Heat advisory this evening. Occasional cloudiness for tonight with a few showers and thunderstorms around. Some strong with heavy rainfall. Warm and muggy, lows mid-70s. Partly sunny for tomorrow, scattered storms, highs into the mid-80s. It's 71 right now.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
We've got Chris from Nina. What's your thought this afternoon, Chris?
Oftentimes you have only one set of viewers that will watch Fox News or watch CNN. What I really actually love and respect from all your viewers is the fact that you tend to have viewers that think on both sides of the aisle. To be open-minded, you need to be willing to listen and learn and possibly change your mind. You don't have to change your mind, but just being willing to listen.
The award-winning Maggie Dawn Show, weekday afternoons from 4 until 6.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, evidently, nobody wants to read about Donald Trump anymore. There are a couple of Trumpite books out there written by the Pragers of the world and some of the other right-wing columnists. And, they're going nowhere. And that's a good thing. Maybe we're just tired of reading about the insanity that's going on right in front of our eyes. And maybe we've wakened up and we want to look for something, well, worth reading. And that's why I'm thrilled to have my next guest come on the program. You may remember Dr. Keith during the pandemic. He was my go-to medical guy because at the time it was an emergency room physician. Was a doctor healing people during the pandemic. Well, he decided that, you know what, I have another calling. Became a middle school teacher and has written a great book called Tickled Soul, The Philosophical Journey of a Doctor Turned Middle School Teacher. Dr. Keith, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, thank you for having me. It's been a while. Great to see you again.
It has been a while, but my buddy Keith Pocheck has written a great book. I highly suggest people go out and get it and read it. So let's start with the obvious. You are a physician, you're a doctor, you went to school, you did all of that stuff to get that degree, to have that esteemed pedestal of healer and chief, and you gave all that up to teach middle school students. Why?
that's the question that I got the most in the first few months after I started and jumped in with both feet and went full-time teaching. And so... appropriate that you asked that, and it really is what compelled the book itself, just because I felt like For a while, I was answering with, well, it's complicated. And that just didn't seem to be an adequate answer for most people, and for me either. So why I made the jump, I think over the years, in emergency medicine and in urgent care medicine where I worked for almost exactly 20 years, I wasn't getting the satisfaction from the job that I previously did. And there was a multitude of reasons. And some of those were things that changed about me. And a lot of those were things that changed about the system itself. So I really just kind of took things back to square one, and said, well, let's start with what I actually believe. And a lot of that's maybe even more philosophical and religious at the beginning anyway. Is it now different than what it was when I was younger? And it is. Those things have evolved and changed. And I think when what you actually believe starts to morph and starts to change and take on a little bit of a new shape, it's going to change your identity and even your purpose to a degree. So I just sort of let myself explore that through various phases of my life and through various phases of my career, and was able to get a lot of it onto paper, and, you know, spent about the course of almost an entire year from sitting down and initially starting the manuscript and having no idea where it was going to go and let it meander. And then toward the final endpoint of having a publisher release it, just like they did today. And it was a certainly an educational experience for me. Got to work with some great people who walked me through a process that I wasn't familiar with really at all. I'm happy, and I hope that I hope that some folks find some inspiration from it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, again, we had talked numerous times over the last several years, and a big part of it, at least from my perspective, when I saw the book was coming out, because you struggled with the changes in the healthcare industry, you struggled with the corporatization, and it really wasn't as maybe I shouldn't testify for you. What was it that made you kind of move away? What were you dealing with? Because look, this is more than just a memoir. It's framed as a philosophical journey. So, you know, what questions were you wrestling with personally, professionally, that led you in this direction?
I think that there was a few years into my career, I don't know that it was a single awakening or just a series of them, but I wasn't feeling the thrill of competence anymore that I think that people get when they have learned a new craft. And that, you know, when that happens, like during residency, which was a 3-year process at a really busy hospital, emergency department in an urban setting, you spend so many hours there and you see so many thousands of cases, and you do these procedures over and over and over. And then, you know, a couple years in, you kind of are one of the go-to people to fix things and to take on challenging situations and, you know, get an airway in someone when other folks are struggling, or, you know, getting dislocated bones back into place. And there's a real thrill with that. But at some point, probably, I don't know, 8-10 or so years in, that thrill of competence wears off. Like, I think maybe that I would compare it to, I don't know, this isn't a fair comparison because I'm not a pilot, but I would say somebody that learns how to fly a plane, that there probably becomes a time where that's no longer nearly as thrilling. And now you're just kind of going through the process again.
So it's almost like factory work then.
Yeah, and then you start to see really a little, some more of the illnesses of the system itself that maybe start to have you preoccupied. Then, you know, maybe there's an internal search there, or a bit of an identity crisis like I went through, to compel you to look for some other avenues that may be more fulfilling.
Because, you know, when I read through this, I'm like, I'm going, you know, most people, you know, aren't able in the middle of their working lives to go, you know what, this thing I've been doing for 20 years, I spent my entire life to get to this point. I'm at the top of my profession. Most people, well, don't have the one, financial ability to make that shift, and two, aren't mentally ready to start all over again and you know, work their way up from the bottom. So I think that's a testament to your character. But also on the financial side, you know, how's your wife taking this? I mean, I know she's a doctor as well, but you know, that's from doctor to middle school teacher, that's got to be a financial hit.
Oh, it definitely was. I mean, it was a tectonic shift. And, you know, every day I'm grateful for her patience and grace in the process. You know, luckily, I was at a point where I'd paid off my loans, and we got to a point where we owed on the house and, you know, wanted to fund our kids' education. And we didn't really owe really much money elsewhere. So for me to even be able to consider that, I know, is just presented an incredible opportunity that most people just don't get to have.
Yeah.
And so, a huge upside to that is that I can go into work and view it as as the blessing that it is, that I was able to, you know, that I was afforded this opportunity. And I think hopefully, that outlook, that perspective sort of shows when I'm teaching. I hope.
Yeah. Two things. One, why tickled soul? What is that? And the other part of this is it's kind of an introspection, a part narrative, part introspection. What are you hoping people get from it? You know, teachers, doctors, either or neither, both. What do you hope they take away from it about purpose, burnout, or just rediscovering the joy of work?
Well, the term tickled soul came from an actual physical sensation that I started to recognize I would get when I was able to, and it started in medicine when I was working in the ER, when I was able to arrive at a truth, when I was able to figure something out and provide some measure of either comfort or relief or closure or something for a patient that they appreciated, that I actually would get a physical sensation that was kind of right at the base of my skull, back of my neck, and would maybe radiate a little upwards and downwards and to each side a slight bit. And it was pleasant. It wasn't an uncomfortable, just almost kind of a tingling feeling. And, you know, I still remember the first case where I actually recognized it, that what was provoking it. You know, there was a lady who thanked me for, you know, arriving at a kind of a complex diagnosis and said, you know, I really appreciate what you just did for me. I know that I'm not easy to figure out, and you spent the time and you listened to me and you figured it out. And that I was walking back to my computer after that conversation, and I felt that. And I said, just made a mental note of it. But then over in the coming months and years, it would happen again in a similar situation where it was really, I guess, a validation of why I was doing what I was doing. And I'm sure that there's a physiologic explanation for it. I don't know that I fully understand it, but neurotransmitters like dopamine and serotonin and oxytocin getting released. So I don't know that I can explain the complexities of the physiology behind it, but I know that there's that certainly exists. But I started to realize that, hey, those validating moments and that feeling is really what the reason that you work, that you do what you do. I started to feel it when residents and nurse practitioners and PA students and medical students were working with me and would pick up a nugget of knowledge and be grateful, or they would understand a concept and be grateful. And so I learned then that teaching could provide the same, you know, just source of satisfaction and validation.
No, that's
even though the healthcare system was crumbling and my work environment was headed the wrong way for years, that there were going to be other ways I could kind of activate that feeling and get that validation.
Yeah, you were finding joy in your work, the reason that you woke up that morning. And I can see how one would translate to the other, because my question was going to be is, you know, you went from being a doctor, you still are clearly, but you know, you went from that being your profession of meeting people usually on their worst days, usually on bad days, to, you know, children who are filled with, you know, with opportunity and potential in all of those things. So I can see a transition being somewhat more rewarding personally, if not definitely not financially, but right. I can see how that works.
Yeah, you know, and I just and I explore this some in the book, because I think that for whatever reason I've always felt like that I've had this abundance, and I don't want to say that I've lived an opulent, abundant life. There are stages of my life where it certainly wasn't that, but there was always enough. Like, you know, I didn't miss meals, even if what I had to eat wasn't maybe my favorite. I drove a car that was beat up and shared it with my sister. And sure, we worked, but we were never, you know, anywhere. We certainly never felt like we were anywhere near impoverished. So I've just kind of had this sense that it's going to be okay, and I have this abundance that, you know, it's a responsibility of that to do what you can to share it and try and perpetuate it.
No, because look, Keith, you know, the reality is I'm sure most people are watching, going in a time where, you know, we're so focused on getting more. I want more income. I want more goods. I want more things. I want easier this or that. To see someone just for the joy of life going, you know what, I'm not happy doing what I'm doing that provides me all of these other opportunities. I want to do something that makes me happy, kind of a big deal. And in a time when many people feel stuck or burnt out in jobs or careers, your story to me offers a model for reinvention, if you will. So the question I have is, what advice would you give to someone who's considering maybe not as major of a professional shift as you undertook, but one that bucks expectations or norms?
I'll repeat a phrase that I said on a podcast that I did with a fellow named Lon Stroshine about, I don't know, maybe a year and a half ago or so, that kind of struck him. It was, you know, if you're in that phase, guilt can kind of overwhelm you. Just the thought that you're thinking of leaving, and you have these sunk costs, you know, you've spent this time and this money and the blood, sweat and tears to get where you are. And, you know, you're pretty successful and now you have a family and you have some other burdens and you have some other responsibilities. And so you almost feel guilty to even be considering leaving that. It feels irresponsible. And I was in a position, fortunately, that, you know, once I involved my wife in some of the thought process and decision making and planning, because I sat with that for a long time, for a number of years, where I thought it was really just a phase that I was going to be able to outlast, something that was temporary. And then at some point I realized it wasn't that anymore, and that I needed to pursue a change. But I think the nugget that I would give is that you shouldn't let your guilt overcome your curiosity. You know, find some ways to explore it, even if it just means to volunteer for a few hours or to go to a seminar somewhere and meet some people and talk to some folks. You know, I put my name on the substitute teacher list, which was in the early phases of how this all started. And this was during a brutal wave of COVID. So they needed me any day I wanted to work. You know, I mean, it was just like, basically, look, you don't wait on us to call you. If you have a day that you're available and you want to work, just show up. We'll find you. But I mean, COVID would go through a department, and that was back when we were quarantining ourselves for 10 days or 2 weeks. So they, you know, they would need you for an extended amount of time. And being able to do that and just being able to work with the young people every day, I think is really just what made the path even that much more clear.
Yeah.
That this is what I was going to do for a living. So, but you have to kind of allow yourself to get into that exploring phase and realize that it doesn't necessarily commit you to anything. And it's not a jump out of an airplane and pull the ripcord and hope the parachute opens. The phase has to last a little longer than that. And it has to be a little more intentional.
No, and I didn't know the part that you had signed up for a substitute. I'm sure that's in the book. But you hit on something that grabbed my attention. You said, because, you know, guilt keeps you in a lot of places. And look, I went through that myself for years. You know, I've done a job for years, and I'm still doing that job because it pays the bills. It keeps a roof over the kid's head. And it's what I thought what I have to do. It's where I make my living. But the idea of going and doing something else has been that guilt that's held me. And I know a lot of other men, and I know probably women too, but from this society, a male standpoint, or at least of my generation, I can see how that guilt would be overwhelming and preclude you from doing anything other than what's putting food on the table.
Absolutely. And this wouldn't be to judge someone who feels like, hey, I can't make this work. I don't intend to do that at all. I was in a very enviable, rare position to be able to do this. And yet
were a doctor. You were the guy, you were the guy everybody looks to. So in this society, in this economy, you were right up there at the top, which is sad to say, because I think teachers should be right there as well.
Agreed. I mean, what's more important? It's you know, and you just watch as the funding for education continues to be threatened and withheld, and it's an infuriating place, and it's sometimes hard not to just to look at the trajectory of the way things are headed and just say, hey, you know, we're never going to pull out of this. It's going to crash and burn. And I developed it. And this is another philosophical sort of place where I've landed, is that it's just all of these battles are forever. They're eternal. They're going to last forever. You know, so there'll be setbacks. There will be advances. There will be small victories and there'll be losses. But it's, you know, we're never going to achieve complete equality. We're never going to eradicate poverty completely. We're never going to establish good healthcare for every person on earth. But that doesn't mean that we stop fighting those battles.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, they're just going to go on forever. If you can help an individual person, if you can empower an individual person to help pull themselves out of poverty, you're advancing this cause that lasts forever. So it can be a little discouraging that, you know, that these battles will never be won. But I think the other side of that is that they'll never be fully lost either. So it's just a matter of carrying them on and finding some inspiration in the places where you find them, and then hoping to inspire other people to do the same thing.
As I always say, you know, you want to change the world, start with your little corner of it. But Keith, great book. I hope folks will take a look at it. Tickled Soul, The Philosophical Journey of a Doctor Turned Middle School Teacher. You can get that at warrenpublishing.net right now in the pre-order section. You can get that, and we'll get links out on social media. Dr. Keith Pochick, I appreciate the time. Great work. I look forward to talking to you again real soon.
Thank you, Rick. Thanks again for having me.
My good friend, Dr. Keith Pochick. Again, check out the book, Tickled Soul, warrenpublishing.net, where you can take a look at that. Want to hear your thoughts. Are you thinking of career change? Thinking of something maybe radical, like, I don't know, going from doctor to middle school teacher? Want to hear your thoughts. Rick at the RickSmithShow.com. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1877. That was the day that a mob began an attack on Chinese workers in San Francisco that killed four people. During the mid-1870s, a depression swept across the nation. White workers from the East Coast headed west, many to San Francisco, hoping to find a job. Skilled Chinese workers who had completed their labor on the Transcontinental Railroad also came to the city. There, the Chinese laborers found work in trades like cigar making and also open laundries. Resentment against the Chinese workers grew in the city's white working class. In the summer of 1877, workers on the East Coast railroads walked off their jobs after their wages were cut repeatedly. A wave of labor militancy washed over the nation. Historians often refer to that summer as the Great Upheaval, a time where capital and labor literally battled in the streets. In San Francisco, the Working Men's Association, a socialist workers' organization, called for a rally in front of City Hall. The meeting began with speeches against the titans of capital. But soon, a group of angry workers began to demand speakers, quote, talk about the Chinese. A mob stormed off to terrorize Chinese residents. They burned 20 Chinese laundries. After the violence ended the next day, the anti-Chinese rhetoric continued. An Irish-born freight handler by the name of Dennis Kearney became the vocal leader of the call that the Chinese must go. Adherence to the anti-Chinese cause came to be known as Kearneyism. The backlash against Chinese workers spread beyond California. In 1882, Congress passed the Chinese Exclusion Act. Solidarity of workers had fallen to racism. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, I want to hear it. rick@thericksmithshow.com. I got to tell you, Keith, a dear friend, been a friend for a long time. And I remember, look, him going through his journey. And a big part of it being that thing that you know, I think all of us struggle with. How do we find a job that, a path that we find rewarding, that's more than just putting food on the table and a roof over our heads? How do we find satisfaction in our work? And look, you know, there's that old saying, how does it go? If you love what you do, you never work a day in your life. There is that. And you know, I look at my journey through the healthcare system and the people that I've, you know, come across, the burnout is real. And especially when you're talking about the high stakes of both careers that he has chosen, the healthcare field and education, the consequences are so great. The stakes are so high. And I understand. I do. You know, I've had conversations with some friends who are like, yeah, I don't get why you'd give up being a doctor and the prestige and the money and all of that just to become a teacher. And you go, look, all of us have been influenced by people who their calling was to become a teacher. And, you know, the more I've wrestled with this idea, the more I think we've, in this country, have got it really backwards and really wrong, which is why Scandinavian countries have a much higher life satisfaction, have a better out. The happiness index seems to be much higher in those places because they treat teachers as actual professionals. And not just in words, like essential or frontline hero or any of that stuff, but actually the dignity of being able to support themselves. Because one of the things that I had to, you know, before I had Keith on the program, I'm like, you know, so what's it like? You know, are you struggling to put school supplies and struggling to do all of the things that we hear? And the reality is he's in a fortunate position. He did well during his doctoring years, didn't live beyond his means. His wife has a good income. So things are good. And it's the kind of thing you want for every working person, the kind of stability, which is why I think the book is well worth a good read. And in this day and age, you know, I'll be honest with you, something that's uplifting, something that's inspiring, something that's, you know, off of the beaten track, well worth it. And that's why I say, you know, take a look at Tickled Soul, The Philosophical Journey of a Doctor Turned Middle School Teacher. I think it's well worth the read, and you know, the thought that goes into it, you know. So good on Keith. I wish him nothing but the best. Hope the book does wildly well. And I hope in this country that we start thinking about, you know, what kind of a future do we want for ourselves, for our children? What kind of vocations do we want for our kids? It's an interesting topic, and I appreciate Keith from coming on and talking about it. I want to hear about your journey. Let me know. You identify? Don't identify? I want to hear it. Rick at therickSmithShow.com. Miss any portion of the program, grab the podcast. Or if you get your favorite podcast, you'll find ours. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
This is 97.9 WGBW Denmark, Green Bay's real news and great conversation, a civic media radio station.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. Brian Koberger, convicted of killing four University of Idaho students, sentenced today to life in prison without the possibility of parole. President Trump attending an artificial intelligence summit in Washington tonight. The president teased the release of the White House AI action plan.
From this day forward, it'll be a policy of the United States to do whatever it takes to lead the world in artificial intelligence, such an important thing happening.
Ghislaine Maxwell, the only person to be convicted in Jeffrey Epstein's sex trafficking ring, has been subpoenaed to give testimony to House investigators. The Wall Street Journal reporting Attorney General Pam Bondi and her deputy Todd Blanche told President Trump in May that his name appears in the Epstein files multiple times, along with many other high-profile individuals. The attorney general reportedly recommending to the president at the time not to release any more files, and the president deferred to the AG's decision. This is ABC News. In Wisconsin.